Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're tackling a really challenging book. It's one that kind of blows up a lot of assumptions about science.
That's right. We're looking at Paul Feyerabend's 1975 work, Against Method, and, well, bombshell is probably a fair description.
It definitely feels like one. So this isn't just a gentle critique, is it?
Oh, not at all. It's a full frontal assault, you could say, on this deeply ingrained idea that science moves forward using one single, reliable, unchanging scientific method.
Which we all sort of learn about in school.
Exactly. And Feyerabend's basic point, his provocation, is that this tidy picture, it's mostly a myth. And worse, actually trying to stick to such a rigid method would probably just stop progress in its tracks.
Okay, so let's get to that really famous phrase right away, the one everyone knows, anything goes. It sounds like, well, pure chaos.
It does, and it's caused a lot of misunderstanding. But his mission, as he saw it, was to unpack how science actually works. He argued anything goes is more of a description.
A description? How so?
If you look back honestly at the big breakthroughs, he says, they almost always involved breaking the rules, using creativity, sometimes just plain opportunism, not following a neat recipe.
Okay. So it's less a prescription for chaos and more a description of messy reality.
Precisely. And understanding that messy reality, challenging this idea of scientific authority as infallible, seems really important today, doesn't it? Especially when we're constantly told to trust the experts.
Definitely. It makes you think about how we know what we know.
So before we really get into the weeds of the arguments, maybe we should say a bit about the man himself, Paul Feyerabend.
Yeah, who was this guy?
Well, he was Austrian, born in 1924. And his background is pretty fascinating. He actually started out studying physics, got into logical positivism.
So mainstream stuff initially.
Very much so. Mm. And he even studied under Karl Popper, you know, the philosopher famous for the idea of falsification in science.
Wow. Okay. So he was right there inside the philosophical heart of science.
Deep inside. He taught at places like Berkeley. He knew the system intimately. But he eventually became this radical outsider, almost deliberately choosing that role.
What pushed him that way?
It's complex, but one major factor often mentioned is his experience in World War II. He served in the German army and was very severely wounded.
Ah.
And that experience seems to have ingrained in him a really deep, profound skepticism towards any kind of authority, any rigid system, any single way of thinking that claims to have all the answers.
You can sort of feel that rebellious energy in the book. He called himself a court jester.
He did. He saw his role as poking fun at the seriousness, the self-importance of the philosophy of science establishment. But don't let the jester part fool you. He used rigorous historical analysis.
So he did his homework.
Absolutely. Deep historical dives. But he presented his findings with passion, with polemic, with, yes, provocation, to really shake things up and challenge what he saw as the sacred cow of scientific method.
Okay, so Against Method, what's the big picture? What's he trying to do in the book itself?
Fundamentally, it's a manifesto. Its goal is to dismantle that polished, idealized image of science, you know, the purely rational, objective, step-by-step process.
Right, the lab coat image.
Exactly. He wants to replace it with a picture that's, well, more historically accurate, messier, more human. Science is this complex activity driven by passion, rhetoric, even aesthetics, not just logic and data.
And the book itself, it doesn't follow a straight line, does it?
No, not really. It's less a linear argument and more like a series of philosophical attacks.
Yeah.
Combined with these really detailed historical case studies, he's trying to show us the back alleys, the messy workshops where discoveries actually happened, often by breaking the supposed rules.
And he introduces some key ideas along the way.
Yes. Three main concepts really stand out. First, what he calls epistemological anarchism, which sounds dramatic, but it's basically a call for pluralism. Many methods are needed, not just one.
Okay. Anarchy as in freedom of method.
Precisely. Then there's counterinduction. This is the idea that sometimes you need to actively develop theories that contradict the known facts to make progress.
Whoa. Okay, we'll need to unpack that one.
We will. And third is incommensurability. This is the idea that when scientific revolutions happen, the competing worldviews, the paradigms, can't actually be directly compared using logic alone because the very meaning of basic terms changes.
Like comparing apples and, well, not even oranges, maybe apples and poems.
That's a good way to put it. And crucially, he doesn't just keep this inside the realm of science. he extends the Kapique to society.
How so?
He argues that science has gained this dominant, almost unquestionable status, like an ideology, and he famously calls for a separation of science and state.
Similar to separation of church and state?
Exactly the analogy. He thinks science should be treated as one important tradition of knowledge among others, not holding a monopoly on truth or state funding.
That's a pretty radical political claim stemming from philosophy of science.
It is. And to see why he felt such a radical step was needed, we have to look at what rules he was arguing against.
Right. What specific parts of the scientific method did he target?
He really focuses his attack on two big principles that were hugely influential in 20th century philosophy of science.
Okay, what's the first one?
The first is something called the consistency condition. It sounds perfectly reasonable on the surface.
It is.
It's the demand that any new hypothesis, any new theory you propose, must be consistent with the established, well-accepted theories we already have.
Makes sense. Don't contradict what we already know works.
Seems logical, right?
Yeah.
But Feyerabend says, hold on. If scientists had actually followed that rule strictly throughout history, well, many of the biggest revolutions wouldn't have happened. Think about quantum mechanics versus classical physics. They are fundamentally inconsistent. If you demanded consistency, quantum theory would have been rejected immediately because it just didn't fit the old framework.
Ah, right. So the rule protects the old theory.
Exactly. It preserves the older theory, potentially blocking a better, more revolutionary one. He sees it as inherently conservative.
Okay, that makes sense. What was the second principle he attacked?
The second one hits closer to home for him, personally. It's the principle of falsification, championed by his own teacher, Karl Popper.
The idea that you test theories by trying really hard to prove them wrong?
That's the one. Find the evidence that refutes it. Now, Feyerabend agrees testing is vital, of course, but he looks at history and says, well, actually, great scientists often don't immediately ditch a promising new theory just because there's some evidence against it, especially early on.
They protect it a bit.
Yes. He argues they often should, and they do. Revolutionary ideas are usually born imperfect. They might have observational problems or unexplained bits at the start. They need some breathing room, maybe even a little protective dogmatism to develop fully before they can really withstand the toughest tests.
So constantly trying to shoot down your own new idea might kill it before it gets a chance to grow.
That's his concern. Premature falsification can be just as bad as blind acceptance.
Okay, so if following these standard rules can actually hinder progress, what does he suggest instead? You mentioned his counter rules.
Right, so the first big one is counterinduction.
This is the one that sounds really wild, developing theories that go against the facts.
It does sound counterintuitive, doesn't it? But the idea isn't just to be wrong for the sake of it. It's about actively creating and exploring hypotheses that are inconsistent with well-established theories or even known facts.
Why would you do that?
The goal is strategic. By developing a competing viewpoint, even one that seems flawed, you can actually expose hidden assumptions or weaknesses in the dominant accepted theory that you wouldn't see otherwise. It's like shining a light from a different angle.
So it's a tool for criticism, for shaking up complacency.
Exactly. It forces the dominant theory to defend itself, reveals its limits. And alongside this, he pushes the principle of proliferation.
Proliferation, meaning more theories.
Lots more. He argues that science thrives not on consensus, but on variety. We should be constantly inventing and exploring many different alternative theories, even competing ones, at the same time.
Like an ecosystem, diversity makes it stronger.
That's a perfect analogy. A theoretical monopoly where only one approach is allowed leads to stagnation. A rich ecosystem of competing ideas keeps science dynamic and healthy.
This all sounds very abstract, though. Does he show it in action?
Oh, absolutely. The historical case studies are really the heart of the book. And the main one, the one he devotes the most space to, is his analysis of Galileo.
Galileo Galilei, the hero of science versus the church.
That's the standard story, isn't it? The lone rationalist with his telescope proving the earth moves, battling ignorance.
Yeah.
Well, Feyerabend completely flips that script. It's probably the most controversial part of the book.
How does he flip it?
He argues that if you really look at the evidence and the accepted rational standards of the 17th century, the arguments against Galileo's Copernican view were actually pretty strong, maybe even stronger at the time.
Wait, stronger against Galileo?
In some ways, yes, based on the knowledge available then. Think about the famous tower argument.
The one where if the earth spins, a drop stone should land to the west?
Exactly. If the earth is whipping eastward at high speed, shouldn't the tower move out from under the falling stone? But stones fall straight down. Galileo didn't have a good mechanical explanation for why that happens on a moving Earth.
So the observations seem to contradict his theory.
Right. Feyerbend points out that the church officials who questioned Galileo weren't necessarily being irrational. They were often pointing to established physics and direct observations that seemed to contradict his radical claims. In a sense, their position could be seen as more scientific by the standards of the day.
Wow. Okay, so if the evidence wasn't clearly on Galileo's side yet, how on earth did he win?
This is where Feyerbend brings in the anything goes idea in practice. He argues Galileo succeeded through, well, methodological sins. He calls Galileo a brilliant but cunning opportunist.
Opportunist? How?
For one, he argues Galileo selectively focused on evidence that supported him and kind of ignored or downplayed the counter-evidence, like the tower argument. He didn't have all the answers, but he pushed ahead anyway.
Okay, a bit of confirmation bias, maybe.
Perhaps. But more than that, Feyerbend emphasizes Galileo's incredible skill in rhetoric and, essentially, propaganda.
Propaganda.
Think about it. Galileo wrote his major works not in scholarly Latin, which only academics read, but in Italian.
To reach a wider audience.
Precisely. He's used dialogues, wits, even ridicule, to make his opponents look foolish and to persuade the educated public, bypassing the conservative university establishment. He used charm, persuasive writing, appeals to aesthetics.
So it wasn't just the data, it was salesmanship too.
Feyerbend would say it was absolutely crucial. Galileo broke methodological rules, used rhetoric, ignored counter-evidence, and played the political game brilliantly. And the result? One of the biggest shifts in scientific history.
So the sin led to the breakthrough.
That's the core of his argument, that historical reality shows progress often requires breaking the rules that philosophers later try to impose. Anything goes isn't an endorsement of sloppiness. It's a defense of the freedom needed to achieve the seemingly impossible.
Okay, that Galileo example really brings it home. Let's try to distill this. What are the main takeaways you think listeners should get from Feyerbend?
Well, I think there are three big themes that really resonate. The first, clearly, is this idea of methodological pluralism or epistemological anarchism, if you like the dramatic term.
The toolbox idea.
Exactly. The world and science are just too complex and unpredictable for one single method to work all the time. Progress requires flexibility, opportunism, sometimes even using methods that seem irrational from another perspective. We need the whole toolbox, not just one hammer.
Makes sense. What's the second?
The second is incommensurability, this idea that major scientific shifts aren't just adding new facts to the old picture, they involve fundamental changes in worldview.
Right, the apples and poems thing again.
Yeah. When you go from Newton's physics to Einstein's, the very concept of mass or time changes meaning. So you can't just line them up and say Einstein is simply more true in a linear way. They speak different conceptual languages. Mm-hmm. It challenges that simple idea of progress toward one final truth.
That really makes you think about how science develops. And the third theme?
The third is really about demystifying science, seeing it as a social and rhetorical activity.
Taking scientists off the pedestal a bit?
In a way, yes. Recognizing that scientists are human beings, passionate, sometimes biased, definitely fallible. They use persuasion, they compete for funding, they're influenced by beauty and elegance and theories. This human element isn't just noise, it's actually part of how science moves forward. Persuasion can be as important as proof sometimes.
And this all connects back to his worry about
scientific dogma. His concern, especially later in his life, was that science was becoming treated as the only valid way of knowing. Almost like a state religion. He felt that unquestioning deference to scientific experts, without democratic discussion or considering other forms of knowledge, was actually a threat to freedom and intellectual diversity.
That's a heavy thought. It certainly makes his provocative quotes hit harder.
He definitely had a way with words.
Oh.
Should we look at a few key ones?
Yeah, let's do that. What's the first iconic line?
Well, we have to start with the big one. The only principle that does not inhibit progress is anything goes.
Okay, so recapping the context, it was methodological, right? That not ethical or anything is true.
Absolutely crucial distinction. He's talking about the methods of scientific discovery. If you impose rigid rules beforehand about how scientists must proceed, you risk preventing the very kind of creative rule breaking that history shows is often necessary for radical breakthroughs.
Got it. Freedom to try unconventional approaches. What's another key quote?
This one captures his political concern. The separation between state and church must be complemented by the separation between state and science.
The analogy we mentioned earlier.
Exactly. He's arguing for cultural pluralism. Just as the state shouldn't endorse one religion, it shouldn't give science a monopoly on truth or funding or decision-making, marginalizing other valuable traditions of knowledge, whether they're artistic, spiritual, or indigenous, for example.
A call for a more level playing field for different ways of knowing.
You could put it that way. He saw the state potentially elevating science to this unchallengeable authority, and that worried him.
Okay, maybe one more. Perhaps about those rules he disliked.
Yes, this one cuts right to his critique of conformity. The consistency condition, which demands that new hypotheses agree with accepted theories, is unreasonable because it preserves the older theory and not the better theory.
That really sums up his argument against that specific rule. You need the inconsistency, the challenge, to potentially find something better.
It highlights his view that protecting the status quo shouldn't be the primary goal.
So this is all fascinating and kind of head-spinning philosophy, but how can, you know, someone listening apply these ideas? Can Feyerabend's anarchy actually be useful in everyday life or work?
Surprisingly, I think so. His seemingly chaotic ideas can actually spark some very practical strategies, especially around innovation.
Like in business, maybe?
Definitely. Think about it. If you're stuck, if your company's hitting a wall, Feyerabend's approach wouldn't just be think outside the box. It would be more like find the most established best practice, the thing everyone knows is the right way to do it, and try doing the exact opposite. Actively pursue the wrong idea, the counterintuitive approach, not because it's guaranteed to work, but because exploring it might reveal the hidden assumptions holding you back. That's counterinduction in practice.
Okay, deliberately trying the bad idea to learn something. I like that. What about on a personal level?
Well, the principle of proliferation could be useful. If you're facing a difficult problem or feeling creatively blocked, don't just brainstorm one or two sensible solutions.
Generate lots of options.
Yes. Consciously generate, say, 10 wildly different possibilities. Include ideas that seem silly, impractical, or totally unrelated. Just creating that variety, that pluralism of options, can often shake loose the real breakthrough. The diversity itself becomes a resource.
So embrace the messiness of brainstorming.
And perhaps most broadly, his work is just a powerful reminder to be skeptical of any single authority claiming a monopoly on truth.
Whether it's scientific, political, economic.
Exactly. It encourages you to question expert claims, not dismissively, but critically, to value diverse perspectives and maybe trust democratic discussion a bit more than pronouncements from on high.
That feels very relevant right now.
I think so, too.
So reflecting on this deep dive, what's the thing that surprised you or stuck with you the most?
For me, I think it's the sheer boldness of his demystification of Galileo and, by extension, science itself. It's uncomfortable, maybe, to see heroes portrayed as cunning opportunists using rhetoric.
Yeah, it challenges the clean narrative.
But it also makes science feel more human, more achievable in a weird way. It acknowledges the passion, the struggle, the messiness involved in really big thinking. It's not just about cold logic.
What resonated with me, I think, was that idea of incommensurability. The notion that we're not always just climbing the same ladder towards truth, but sometimes switching to entirely different ladders or even different games.
Yeah, it fundamentally challenges simple notions of progress.
It does. It makes you appreciate the diversity of thought much more rather than just seeing older ideas as wrong.
Absolutely. And I think that leads to the final takeaway. Ultimately, Against Method isn't really for anarchy in the sense of chaos. It's an anti-dogmatism book.
A plea for open-mindedness.
And intellectual humility. The biggest lesson might be just that. Be skeptical of rigid rules. Be willing to be flexible, opportunistic, even a bit mischievous in your thinking. Progress often requires that courage.
Recognizing that pluralism, that diversity of thought and method, isn't a problem to be solved, but maybe our greatest strength.
I think Feyerabend would argue it's essential for freedom itself.
A really provocative thinker. Thanks for unpacking all that.
My pleasure. It's a book that definitely makes you think.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.